The smell of a kitchen preparing for Shabbat is something that I can pick up on from half a block away. Challah baking, chicken roasting, barley warming, soup simmering. Drop me into a Jewish house, likely anywhere in the world, getting ready for Friday night, and I'll instantly feel at home. Food and Judaism are undoubtedly, inextricably tied, with each dish carrying a piece of familial history, cultural lineage, and nostalgic attachment. We've discussed this on the show with Rachel B. Gross when we talked about Jewish nostalgia and our tie to delis. It's been mentioned on our episode about smells and religion with Kara Hoover and Deborah Green. But I think it's time to hit the nail on the head and talk about food. If you've been here before, you know that there's only one person for this conversation. Mensch of the Millennium, Jake Cohen. Jake has an incredible history as a chef, having cooked at some of New York's finest establishments, including ABC Kitchen. He's done incredible work for the food media world, including being the food critic for Time Out New York, serving as food editor of TastingTable.com, and editorial and test kitchen director for one of my favorites, The Feed Feed. Jake studied at the Culinary Institute of America, or CIA, one of my favorite campuses in the world to visit. And he's now a New York Times best-selling author for his incredible book, Jew-ish, Reinvented Recipes for a Modern Mensch. If you follow Jake's Instagram, you know of his insanely beautiful cheese boards and accessible, fun cooking tutorials, as well as being Britney Spears' latest inspiration in the kitchen. Jake's book is a staple in my kitchen. I've learned so much from him regarding unexpected ingredient combinations. His book really changed the cooking game for me. I mentioned recently that Jake and I had lunch in New York not too long ago, and I'm excited to invite you into our conversation. Along with Rabbi Jess, who has sadly reached the end of her tenure on the show for now, we're going to talk about all things Jewish food, our connection to how we prepare our meals and where those ingredients come from, the incredibly long journeys that dishes take to get to our tables, and Jake's journey, as he's learned it all. An extra special thanks to Rabbi Jess, who's been such an amazing partner both in front of the mic and behind the scenes here. She's brought such beautiful Torah to us, has had brilliant ideas that became the basis of the episodes we did with her, and as Jake will tell us, her work outside of this show has brought meaning and connective tissue to so many people's lives. So if you're listening, Jess, which I know you are, thank you. Next week, we've got a very special co-host lined up to finish out the cycle with us for the final few Parshas, and I'm very excited to be back in conversation with a study favorite and founder. More on that next week. For now, you can reach out and tell us how much you love Jess and Jake on Twitter at study_show. Support us as we seek to make more of these episodes in meaningful ways on patreon.com/thestudy. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and tell a friend. On to the show. As always, very excited to welcome back to the show, Rabbi Jess Minin. For your last episode for the moment, I'm going to try not to break down in tears, but I'm so, so glad to have you back. We missed you last week, so thanks for showing up.
Missed you too. I don't know what I'm going to do without you, Raviv. Good to be here.
We'll just keep it going. I mean, we can still do Torah study together. It doesn't always have to be in the public sphere. We can hang out and we can just hang out. That's okay too. And today I am so excited. I've been talking about this guy for ages on this show. I can't help but talk about him and his book and his friendship and his sweetness. And we are all just so lucky today to have Jake Cohen on the show. Welcome to The Study.
Long time listener, first time caller. Very excited to be here.
Wow, I feel like this feels like a big moment in the show because you and I have been actually talking about this show since before its inception. Like when I first started thinking about it, I gave you a ring and I was like, what do you think about this? What could this look like? And since we've been in touch about the evolution of it, and now we're like almost at the end of an entire cycle of Torah, we've done it, Jake. We did it and you've been a part of that. So thank you.
I mean, thank you. I think this has always been the missing piece to my Friday night ritual. We'll get into obviously it all, but I don't really go to shul that much on Fridays, but this has become part of like my challah, like dough making rituals that I put on The Study. I learn a little bit about what the Torah portion is, and there we go.
I love that. You're in good company. I think a lot of our listeners are not shul goers. I mean, especially in the past year and a half. And I know that one of my best friends since childhood, Julie Rappaport, does the exact same thing. It's challah making in the morning with some of the podcast and just like a little bit of hopefully grounding and or whatever it is. I don't know what people get out of this, but it seems like people are listening. So thanks. This week we're gonna, you know, we're still in this book of Deuteronomy. We are doing a lot of speech stuff. We get to talk about first fruits, which we're gonna get into, but maybe Jess, is this the time to give us the Torah portion, let us know what's going on, and then we'll circle back to Jake and everything we want to talk about today.
It will come as no surprise that I love this Torah portion.
I'm not surprised. You are right.
Ki tavo, literally, when you come. This is talking to you as in us, as in the Israelites. When you come into the land, this is going to be a description, an explication, expounding upon things that we should do. What should we do right away? What's the first thing? Now, this is a really interesting question, and the answer that we encounter here in chapter 26 is not what you would think would come first. When you come into the land, one of the first things you should think about is this idea of first fruits, what comes to be known as bikurim. Here in the Torah portion is described as reshit pri ha'adama, literally reshit or rosh, the head or the first, pri, fruit, ha'adama, of the ground. The first fruits of the ground should be set aside in some way. This is a concept, this idea of setting aside the first or the best is a concept that we've actually encountered before in the book of Deuteronomy, also in Numbers and a little bit in Exodus, that we have to be in relationship with that power greater than ourselves that we call God or Adonai, using the land and its produce as a proxy. Because the land will only be bountiful for us if we are in that relationship. And we'll unpack a little bit more about the connection between produce and food and a sort of transcendent idea of relationships and spirituality a little bit more with our exceptional guest. The chapter continues with a very interesting passage. It's well known because it's included in the Passover Haggadah, which is Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering or fugitive or lost Aramean. And it's actually given over as this is what you should say when you come to present or give these first fruits to the temple. And it's very cryptic. Like, why is this the passage that you would say? And then why do the sages excerpt this passage about first fruits in the Passover Haggadah, which seemingly has nothing to do with first fruits? Or does it? There's an interesting connection here between what it means to be free and what it means to be a people and how we think about produce and land and food. And it concludes and includes a beautiful description that we're going to have over and over again in this Torah portion about the land as Eretz Zvat Chalav Udvash. And this is famous in English as well, that this is a land flowing with milk and honey. And I do want to say that we are not talking about cow's milk and bee honey. We are talking about almond milk and date honey.
And it's a very hip.
Yeah, right. And it's very different. Like, I grew up thinking that we're talking about, like, milk, it does a body good, and apples and honey. And that's not, it's not actually what we're talking about. And I think that's important because the way that we think about food can, and I think maybe should, be inspired by some of this stuff.
Can I ask just how we know that it's almond and date honey? How do you make that?
Sure. We the sages. I'm just gonna group myself with Chazal now.
You're one of my sages, yeah.
Thank you. The sages actually talk about this quite a bit, and talk about what the produce of the land is and what types of cattle and what types of produce and what types of crops. The crops that are mentioned in conversation around milk are almonds, not in context of talking about cattle, like goats or cows or other types of, it would have been goats or sheep actually in the ancient Near East, not talking about that type of milk. This comes up in discussions in the Mishnah and the Gemara and other later rabbinic texts. And the same thing with honey. There's a lot of conversation around the seven species, that which are the seven types of foods that are mentioned in the Torah. And we're not talking about bees. We're talking about dates. And date honey, as I'm sure Jake will help us understand, those are pretty different things. And so thinking about the way that you want food to play a role in meaning making in your life actually shifts when you shift your understanding of the food that they were talking about. This continues in chapter 27 with another thing that we should do, kitavo. When you come into the land, you should build an altar. How do you do that? It's going to be made out of standing stones, large stones that are going to be stood up and coated with plaster. If you go to Israel, Palestine today, you can actually see standing stones still existing and just standing up. They're there intentionally. And we're pretty darn sure that they are there to be altars. For whom, we're not sure, but it's actually cool sometimes when you can see the thing in real life that you read about in an ancient text. The rest of the portion is a very large section of the delivery of blessings and curses. This is not the first time, my friends, that we have engaged in some blessings and some curses. And again, it's in the context of, if you do what I have told you to do, the speaker being God through Moses, these are the blessings and these are the curses. And it's actually a curse sandwich. We start with curses, we have blessings in the middle, and then we end with curses, a lot of curses. And that takes us through chapters 27 and 28. And I do want to note, because I think the choreography of ritual is actually pretty cool, when this Torah portion is chanted in public, the curse sections are actually chanted in a quieter voice or a quieter tone than the rest of the Torah portion, because we don't want that. So I think it's kind of cool when there's a little bit of, you know, theater, because ritual is a type of theater involved in the way that we deliver the text and its meaning even today. And lastly, we close out with chapter 29, verses 1 through 8, which is kind of like a coda, a bit of a final reminder that you've been taken care of. You, Israelites, you've been taken care of. Go into the land, do what I've said, don't screw it up. Dun, dun, dun.
I do like this idea of quiet, like, we're still going to yell all the curses, but we're not going to yell them. Actually, we're just going to quietly mention them. It's like a very gentle curse, which is lovely. Just lovely.
Curse light.
Yeah, it's curse light.
Your skin's going to fall off, but we're going to say it quietly.
Yeah, but it's going to be really cute. Okay, so what we're going to take out of all of this for today, we're going to be talking about this first fruit thing, kind of like a pour one out. Is that the basic tenet of Bikurim?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, again, we've seen this in other ways. So we have a few examples of quote-unquote first fruits, which is essentially set aside the first or the best of what we produce, whether that's literal produce or animals and animal products. We even actually do this with people. This is the idea of the birthright, that the firstborn son has a different status than everyone else in the family. And we still today have a practice called Pidyon Haben, which is redeeming the firstborn son from prescribed temple service. So there are like very real and not so tenuous connections that we can make here, but it's definitely a pour one out kind of idea. with a very sort of transcendent or spiritual underpinning. So like pour one out, but do it for God. Because what we're trying to do here is make a connection between the people and God using the land as a kind of proxy. And this is hugely important in an agrarian society. And you see it play out as rabbinic law evolves in the Mishnah and the Talmud and beyond, that we as Jews are commanded to think deeply and critically, not only about our food, but where it comes from, who harvests it, how it's harvested, who it feeds, right? The food's not just for you and me, it's for the poor and the widow and the orphan, etc. And so that's the connection here. When we say ki tavo, when you come, it's ki tavo el haaretz. It's in relationship to the aretz, to the land.
Jake, there's also, in making challah, isn't there like you're supposed to toss a piece of it aside?
But I think what is really interesting is the interpretation of that. So you have some that let a little piece burn, and there's actually this whole prayer. I know you had Rabbi Amichai on as a guest in the past, and I was on this one Zoom with him at some point in the past year and a half, in which he was kind of talking about that. But another interpretation in terms of the division of a piece of the challah is baking an extra challah and giving it to someone who wouldn't have challah otherwise. And I think in that idea of like pouring one out, yes, but to me, pouring one out is always so wasteful. And what I've always gotten from this, and what I've always gotten from so much of Jewish ritual and tradition is there's a lot more intention to it and a lot more good being done with that.
Yes, I love that. I've been able to learn from you so much about cooking, including date honey. First time I ever used date syrup, date honey. I don't know if they're the same thing. Was absolutely
same thing, because, also known as Ceylon.
Well, yeah, the first time I used Ceylon was because of you and your book, and I still put it on my Brussels sprouts. Absolutely delicious. But I am so curious to hear more about you and your journey. We're talking about firsts. I want to know your first love in cooking, the first time you realized this is what you wanted to do. I think I told you once I had like kind of dreamed of going to CIA, Culinary Institute of America, just because I got to visit the campus once and thought it was absolutely amazing. So tell us a little bit about your journey and how you found yourself where you are.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up really as a Food Network disciple, where I would come home from school and I would turn it on and I was just enamored with Ina and Giada and Rachel Ray, and they were everything to me and inspired this need to cook for others. And I started throwing these little dinner parties and they were garbage. Like I wasn't making good food or choices, or there wasn't any intention behind the actual meal itself. However, I became almost addicted to that relationship of hospitality, of inviting people into your home, cooking for them, that real back and forth in terms of the care that you put into nourishing others and the way that it makes them feel and the way that it makes them react to you in response. It's quite powerful. And it really is what I think got my husband and I into Shabbat later in life, which is something that we didn't really do as kids, but as young 20-somethings in New York, it was that same vibe of really, really, really loving a dinner party, loving an opportunity to extend hospitality to those you love and those you might not know, but creating a space in which you can really get closer with others.
Yeah, that resonates. I felt like for a while I was using Shabbat as an excuse to have a dinner party, but like an excuse to have a dinner party that had intention behind it.
Yes.
That was really special. And at what point did that love of, I guess, the power and attention that you got as a chef extraordinaire become more of a career?
I'm someone who has these fantasies, and I, like, just if it doesn't match my fantasy, it's not happening. I need just to make whatever in my head happen. So I wanted to pursue cooking. So I applied to CIA, and it was the only college I applied to. There was no backup. It was like, wow, this is what I'm doing. So that's what I did. And it was an incredible experience. Really, anyone who visits the campus, it's like Disney World. It's this old Jesuit monastery on the edge of the Hudson River in Hyde Park, New York. So stunning. And then I went and worked in restaurants, because that's what happens when you finish school like that and you are really ingrained with this idea of, like, go out and work in the best place you possibly can. But that wasn't for me.
What is the application process for CIA? Because I never got that far.
I know it's different now, but when I applied, you had to write an essay, do all this stuff, and then you had to have 6 months of restaurant experience before you showed up. So even if you didn't have it, you were conditionally accepted and could only show up once you had a letter from a restaurant that you had worked in for 6 months, which for, again, many people who are going to CIA are they've already done college, they're career changers, but there's a huge group of people like me who came straight from high school, and I was a child, and it was quite difficult to find a restaurant and be like, all right, you can come work here. And I literally worked for free in this awesome spot on Long Island, and I was like paid in sandwiches and salads. I would just take home dinner every night, and I had a blast, and I learned a lot. And it was one of the first experiences that, again, didn't prepare me for then going to a three Michelin star restaurant, but at the same point, like, I didn't want to stay in a three Michelin star restaurant anyway. So it's all part of that journey to kind of expose you to the food world and how broad it is. Really, like, the number of jobs that you can do all touching the space, it's endless.
The next chapter of your career, which does incorporate Judaism and Shabbat, and I mean, your cookbook is kind of like a Bible for so many people on Friday nights and holidays, to be able to go and have some guidance to how to make these beautiful Shabbat dinners. Where did those two worlds and when did those coincide?
I transitioned into media, and I was working in test kitchens for different magazines, websites, and it really was like that, I always describe it like Devil Wears Prada mentality of the editorial staff and keep your head down, and it's whatever the higher ups deem is good or quality, and you have all these gatekeepers on what's good food and what is hip and what should be covered. And I can tell you what wasn't covered, and that was Jewish food. Jewish food came up maybe twice a year. We get like one bone thrown at Passover, another at Hanukkah. And I was really looking to get any opportunity I could. And that meant when I was working at Sever, digital was secondary to the magazine because the magazine is the holy grail. So I would pitch for digital and they would give it to me because that was considered second tier. So around Rosh Hashanah, I pitched my family's apple cake recipe and a story about the history of it from my aunt who grew up in Havana, because when her side of the family fled Europe, they ended up in Havana, Cuba, where she was born and raised, and about this apple cake that my great-grandmother started making in Havana that she learned from one of her friends in this small Jewish community that had settled there. And it was the first time that I really felt like I was adding something to the food world, that I was speaking with real meat. And I think that great recipes are fun and nice and the world needs them, but what people really resonate with are stories, anecdotes, that next level in which they're able to connect and see themselves in whatever piece of content they're digesting, whether that is a book, a TV show, a podcast, a recipe. So when I really started leaning into that, which was something that I always kind of kept in the back burner because I didn't grow up incredibly religious. We were secular. We definitely were Passover Seder two nights, just fast on Yom Kippur, went to temple for Erev Rosh Hashanah and Kol Nidre. But other than that, it was very chill. And being Jewish was not so much in like the front seat. And then when I started writing about Jewish food, it became very clear, actually, everything in my life is touched, whether in a big or small way, by Judaism. I just hadn't had the context to understand it.
Now that you followed that route, you're getting like re-Instagrammed by Britney Spears. So really, you've really reached some zenith in the Jewish food world that I don't think anyone has gotten to yet. So I commend you and thank you for your service.
That's been the fun part is making Jewish food cool again. I think that's one of the big things that comes up a lot, especially in even this conversation on milk and honey. We think of honey as bee honey because of the fact that it was such a prominent ingredient in Ashkenazi food culture. Something like seitan, it is the dominant sweetener in Mizrahic Jewish kitchens. The haroset for Iraqi Jews are simply chopped walnuts and date syrup. This is something that's so integral to the kitchens of an entire section of our diaspora that we just don't know about because we live in a very Ashkenormative society. So I see this opportunity for myself, for so many people in this space to do two things. On one side, we need to broaden this view because I really do think that Larry David single-handedly has exposed America to Jews and this Seinfeld-esque picture, which is amazing because we really have seen like an understanding of babkas and all of this stuff that seemingly wouldn't be mainstream. However, it's pigeonholed Jewish food, Jewish people into this one specific narrative when it's much, much, much broader. And then the other side of that is Ashkenazi food has this like bad rap. And I kind of blame a few friends of mine talk about this and he's a dear friend. So I'm totally going to be like fine dragging him. I blame Michael Solomonov, the incredibly famous chef of Zahav in Philadelphia, who has really invigorated this passion for Israeli cuisine in America and having it be this like hot, exotic, spiced, flavorful cuisine. And it's been at the cost of saying Ashkenazi food is bland and brown. And I don't agree with that. I think that Ashkenazi food, I mean, I think that the history of these peoples are very much coloring the extravagance of the dishes based on the wealth of the shtetls and, well, the lack thereof. But we are in America now and seeing so many young Ashkenazi chefs take these dishes and reimagine them for the modern kitchen, the modern palate, introduce new ingredients, make them brighter, fresher, bigger. I don't think that's an excuse anymore. I think Ashkenazi food is just as incredible as Mizrahic food, just as incredible as Sephardic food. We're all great and we should just be celebrating everyone.
Oh, I love that. And it feels to me like, this is obviously so tied to my own family history, but for me, the Ashkenazi food is like soul food. Mm-hmm. Each dish comes with a history and a story. Like you say, the apple cake, like that, each thing is coming from a long line of ancestry and from different countries. And so it feels like a Shabbat dinner table is a place where all of these stories are kept alive in some way or another. And I love that.
For sure.
There are so many ways to plug into Shabbat, new, old, and everything in between. Sometimes I'm cooking with Jake's book, and often I'm using the tools that one table has to offer. From ritual and holiday guides to actual financial gifts to help bring dinner to the table, One Table has got you covered. Head over to onetable.org to get started. Jess, when it comes to first fruits, and you're talking about connection to land and the holiness, like what are the bigger themes that the Torah is trying to share with us?
Well, I do think that there is an agenda.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, right. Well, Torah is in and of itself a recipe. Torah means instructions, and what you're cooking is how you're going to make meaning in your life. You're cooking up some meaning. And so you don't have to dig particularly deep beyond the pshat or surface level of the text to get to something pretty darn profound. And in this case, I think it has to do with our connection to land and food itself. And I do want to bring, I don't often bring a midrash on the pod, but we're going to go there today. Midrash being what we mentioned a few weeks ago, like kind of like the fan fiction that the sages are creating to help us, well, perfect the recipe, essentially, to like really get the flavor to pop. That's what Midrash is here to do. And there's this really beautiful Midrash that teaches that the world, the entire world, is created because of three quote unquote merits or good things that people have the potential to do. And those three things are challah, tithes, which is ma'aser in Hebrew, and first fruits. And that's weird. Because of all the amazing things that people have the potential to do, why is it these three sort of slightly esoteric, agrarian, setting aside food things, right? And so the rabbis jump on this and say, the word reshit, or the word for creation, bereshit bara Elohim, like in the beginning, God creates. That word reshit is used to describe these three things. And it's very intentional. Reshit pri hadama. This is the head or the first of the pri hadama, the fruit of the ground. So why are these three things used? Why is this word reshit used to describe these specific things? And that's how they go back to this idea of it has to do with the purpose of creation. If the purpose of creation is Torah, i.e. there's a world, and how we make meaning in it and of it is the recipe, the Torah. So think about this in terms of like the visible world that we can see and feel and touch, and the invisible aspects of being a human being, like how we live in the world and how we make meaning. And the parallel that they use is body and soul. Body is holy, it's physical, we can feel it, we can see it, we can touch it. And the soul is the holy of holies. It's transcendent. It's rooted in meaning making. And this is where Midrash gets really cool. And Jake, you'll have to tell us how recipes evolve, because I would imagine that this is also how recipes evolve, where the Midrash says, you know what would make this flavor pop? Is if we then say, well, wait a minute, the body is holy? The corporeal physical body is holy? Isn't the body the most animal-like part of us? It's our base needs. It's dependent on biological functions. How does that work? What's holy about our bodies? What sanctifies our body? And the answer, oh God, I love this stuff. Listen to this. The answer is food. Food becomes the quote-unquote bridge that the rabbis use to connect our bodies and our souls. And so these things, the separation of challah, the tithing of wine and oil and grain and first fruits, these are the things that elevate, along with things like kashrut or blessing our food before we eat it, making a bracha. It elevates physical food to a higher spiritual plane. And all of a sudden, food becomes a channel or a path towards actually connecting our nourishment, our bodies to our souls and to something that can be transcendent.
I think this actually touches upon two things. You have this one thing, especially tied to Judaism, which I naturally will be doing since we are on a Torah podcast. On one end, you have this idea of the diaspora, which is my favorite conversation on how recipes evolve. In the same way that we talked, I just mentioned about the kind of history of like origin recipes, the recipes that were mentioned in Torah, the foods mentioned in the kind of old school shtetls of Eastern Europe. And then from there, as Jews move, as they've had to based on persecution, war, strife, the resettling comes with taking these recipes, taking these core dishes that are tied to Jewish ritual, and then reimagining them based on what's available, what they start to love in the area they are in. I think of my husband's family, they're Iraqi, but his grandparents are the last generation that lived in Iraq after the Jews were expelled in 1950. And his mother grew up in between Israel and Iran. And the way she cooks Iraqi dishes has Iranian influence, and the way she makes Persian dishes has Iraqi influence, and those are part of the stories that make it inherently Jewish. And naturally, that's what gets people angry, because it's not very succinct in terms of understanding. It's this one thing. Like, no, it's a little bit of everything. And you see the same thing in terms of brisket. Brisket's one of my favorite things, because we really like, with Middle Eastern dishes, with things that come from, I guess, I don't know, anywhere outside of Europe, we really like to have it defined as one dish. There is one version of blank versus something like brisket. Brisket comes to America, Jews settle all around. You start to see these variations that are a lot more normalized, where in the Midwest and the South, people are adding Heinz chili sauce or ketchup or Coca-Cola or any of these things that to me just sound absolutely wild. But for so many Jewish families, that's just what they know. And that is what they understand as the proper way to make it for the way that their family celebrates Jewish ritual. That continued evolution and understanding, it's part of the excitement of what is so great about being Jewish. And we're seeing this even more so now as I don't know, like, I think my book, it's a perfect example of, I'm Ashkenazi, my husband's Mizrahi. A lot of these recipes are taking elements of both and marrying them together, not in a way that has actual history of Jewish communities in these areas, but it's part of this new era of Jewish joy in America and the way that food is evolving.
And it's so beautifully put. And I love what you're saying about, like, the ritual nature around food as a whole is the, like, your actual marriage, the marriage of those two backgrounds in food. Is that part of the way that you see ritual in food? Like, what is your own personal connection to that? Because I imagine as a chef, just sometimes the chopping can be a meditation, and like, there's a grounding nature to so much of what you do. Do you find, you know, with this idea of Bikurim, where it's like really putting something sacred on food and making something that is otherwise not necessarily holy, holy, it adds meaning to the whole experience. Where do you find that personally?
I think it is in this concept of nourishment. What we actually need to be nourished, you think of, I mean, in my head, it always goes to like people on those crazy diets where they're just seeing like, you could have boiled chicken breast, broccoli, and quinoa every day, and you could live a very healthy life. However, the idea of nourishment past that, of all of these dishes that are created with symbolism, we're getting to the idea of sweet things with Rosh Hashanah, the Seder plate, all of the descriptors and the ways that we use food as this jumping off point for conversation or understanding. And then the second part of that is the comfort thing that you mentioned earlier, Raviv, is I think of my like last meal, which people, it's the favorite thing people love. It's the biggest cliche to ask a chef. It's like, what's your favorite restaurant? And it's like, what's your last meal? Those are the questions people ask. And for me, the answer is always deli. It's a bowl of matzo ball soup and it's a pastrami on rye. And that is what my definition of comfort food is. A lot of people are like, what? That's what you're going to have? That's crazy. But I couldn't think of anything else that I would want more. I have matzo ball soup year-round. In the middle of summer, I'm still drinking or eating it. But I did remember what I wanted to say earlier about recipes. And the interesting thing about this that I do think ties in really well to the even concept of the Midrash is this idea of we do what we do because we do it. And so much of Jewish ritual is just inherited. And that's no different when it comes to recipes. The ways that family makes things typically have these quirks and these steps that are just followed because that's what the recipe calls for. However, as we start to look deeper, a key part when I was researching and trying to transcribe a lot of my husband's family recipes, the one really in conversation is kubbah. Kubbah, it could look very different depending on where you are in the Middle East, but for Iraqi Jews, a very common version is kubbah shawandar, which is this red kubbah and the sweet and sour beet broth. And these are these dumplings of a semolina or rice-based dough stuffed with meat. And it's absolutely delicious. and I'm following all of his aunts around the kitchen with measuring cups and a scale, trying to jot down everything so that someone in his family can finally have the recipe written down, because it's all just in their heads. And they measure with like teacups and glasses, and they're just like using handfuls. But something that really stuck out at me is there was the step of washing and drying the rice before this one particular aunt ground it up. And I was so perplexed on why she did it and what it added from a food science perspective. And the more I dug in and had conversations, I ended up coming to the realization that this was because back in Iran, there were twigs and stones and dirt, and this was a way for cleaning the rice. And it's a step that's no longer relevant, but it's just done because that's how it was always done. And once you start diving into those deeper understandings of the why of these instructions, you're able to have a little bit more perspective of, well, I can adjust this slightly and we're still going to get the same result. And it's a slippery slope to some, but I do think that it's an important aspect of the process to think about.
Jess, what about you? I mean, I imagine that being a mom makes the whole ritual around food to be a little more difficult when sometimes you just got to get something on the plate. What are your connections to like ritual and food? Does that come just on Shabbat? Is that something more of an all around?
Yeah, I mean, definitely as a mom, but I should say that I never had that relationship with food. I have never felt that way. I didn't have a connection or any kind of meaning-making connection around food. I never fell in love with it as a kid, but I do remember growing up baking with my mom, and she would always crack the eggs into these little glass bowls before adding them to the mix we were baking for the chocolate chip bars. And I never thought twice about it. That's what you do. When you crack an egg, you crack it into the little glass bowl and you look at it in the glass, ostensibly to make sure there are no pieces of shell in it. I just never asked because that's just what you did.
Yeah.
I did end up becoming a rabbi and get pretty invested in halacha and Jewish law and around food. And you do that to check for blood spots in eggs. Mm-hmm, and she, mm-hmm. When I asked her why she did it, she said, because that's what her mom did. There was no sense of like, well, we're looking for blood spots in the eggs, so this can be kosher. We didn't keep kosher, but we still did this thing. But I didn't have the connective tissue there until much later. And I think that's sort of indicative of a larger Jewish story, which is that so many of us are missing a piece or missing a beat. And so without that piece, you can still create something beautiful and delicious and meaningful. But with that piece, then you start to realize that food is ritual. Food is memory. Food is a memory of the fact that my family at one point kept kosher. My grandmother learned from her mother to check her eggs for blood spots. And in terms of thinking about food as in a transcendent sense, or like what's the connection of food and ritual? I mean, Jake, you said this so beautifully, like, food is glue. It is emotional glue. You literally put it on the table and take two people on either side and put them together and they stick. When you break bread with someone, it changes your relationship. Food is an invitation to be in relationship, and that can be ritualized. And we do that all the time. Cultures and religions in general do that all the time. But I find myself, you know, feeling a sense of pride, like real pride in the way that Judaism essentially sets that table, sets us up to do that through food and through ritual that uses food to symbolize or as a prop. And it's very powerful. It's powerful as a Jew in the pew, so to speak, as someone who practices this faith. And it's powerful as a rabbi. I use food all the time, right? To help people have a sensual and sensory connection to what's going on in their world. It's powerful stuff.
That was exactly what I mentioned earlier in the concept of I came to the realization that everything in my life, whether in a big or a small way, is touched by Judaism. And I think more and more we have a generation of Jews as we think about the secularization of our community, especially coming to America, that's just missing that piece. And the examples of that are endless. In terms of First Fruit, I was so excited about this portion because I'll never forget at my my husband's brother's wife, my husband's brother also married into an Ashkenazi family. So we are all one big, mixed, beautiful, happy Jewish family. But I'll never forget at her father's funeral, she was talking about his teachings to his daughters. And one of the things with First Fruit is it's a tenth of the harvest or whatever. You're the rabbi, Jess, so you could do this specific. But the parallel is that she was talking about from a very early age, they were always instilled that 10 cents of every dollar they made had to go to charity. And obviously we're not in an agrarian society anymore, but it's the little things like that that are actually so strongly tied to Torah that you don't actually know. And once you understand it, it's like shakes you to your core.
You know, we're ending this year coming up soon with Rosh Hashanah, and we're ending a beautiful few weeks with Jess, which just gave me chills, the fact that we did it, and it's been so amazing. So I feel like we should end with abundance and sweetness, and we're getting ready for these high holidays in a couple weeks. And we talked about it a little bit here, milk and honey, more so almond milk and date honey. What you got for us, Jake? What do we do with these two things?
The thing that I always wanted to do with the pantry section of my book, which is most cookbooks will have a pantry section, it's really just like a guideline in terms of instructions of what are the ingredients that you should stock up on so that when you want to cook, you want to bake, these are the things to have on hand. And a lot of people found it quite shocking that it was so broad, because I really wanted to touch on different aspects of the diaspora. So in the same way that there's schmaltz and there's kasha, there's also sumac and date syrup. We live in a world in which you can get these ingredients so easily. Every Whole Food has date syrup. But luckily, the fact is, like, you're describing ingredients. All the ingredients in the Torah just sound like they're coming out of Brooklyn, because it's very much part of this, like, resurgence of the way we used to eat and holistic. And you could use date syrup pretty interchangeably with honey. It's going to have a much deeper caramel molasses tone to it, but viscosity is the same. You could even swap out, like, if you were making my challah recipe, which I'm naturally partial to, you could swap out the honey one for one with date syrup, and it would be just as incredible. I use it all the time in baking. I use it all the time, as you know, in roasting vegetables. And same thing with almond milk. I think more often than not, we have this, again, in a very Brooklyn way, this like push towards more parv baking as people are steering away from dairy. Mm. And it's really nice. I mean, whether you just put in you make yourself an almond milk latte and use date syrup instead of sugar, like, Dainu, that's enough. Like, I just don't think that you need to be going wild. But baking, I think, in the same way that we know so much because of the Ashkenazi richness around honey cake, see, like, date syrup cakes are just as delicious. Swap in the honey one for one with date syrup, and instead celebrate things a little more according to Torah.
I love that so much. And Jake, I just can't tell you how meaningful your book has been to so many, myself included. My mom has the book, and we both try recipes and talk about it and talk about how amazing it's been. It's brought my family literally closer together. Jewish Reinvented Recipes from a Modern Mensch is on the shelves everywhere. It is so exciting. I've been traveling lately, and everywhere I go, I see it and I'm reminded of you and the beautiful work you're doing. I am so grateful for you joining us for this week's episode. Thank you for being here, Jake.
Honored to be here. Truly, truly, truly.
And Jess, my goodness, what a ride. Honored as always, to be in conversation with you, and your guidance and your wisdom and everything that you've shared here has just been so special. I know our listeners have had quite a time. I'm just so glad to have had this opportunity with you.
The honor has been mine. This is the most fun thing I've done in a long time, and I'm grateful for you, Ruby, for creating it.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we should all just continue to do this. Jake is all over the place doing events, so check out. Where do people find out where you are and how to be there?
So I always say there are many Jake Cohens in the world. I am the only at Jake Cohen, so there's that. And also, ooh, I totally forgot that I wanted to say the most important thing about being on this podcast today is that I get to be on it with Rabbi Jessica, because of the fact that, like, this whole process wouldn't have happened without One Table. And the resources that Jess has helped create along the ways has been so, so foundational to my journey to rediscovering passion in Jewish ritual and identity. So truly, this is like beshert that we are all here today chatting.
So I said earlier that I didn't have a strong relationship with food and didn't think I could cook. I'm not that kind of person, right? Especially now with a kid. And in the early days of One Table, like OG One Table host, there was this guy, Jay Cohen, who I kept reading his descriptions and I kept hearing about his dinners. And I'm like, okay, I love this stuff. I need to give myself more of a chance. And it really makes a huge difference. And it's not about frequency. I don't necessarily do it every week, but when I do it now with more intention and love than I ever have before. I realize that I can cook.
It's very Ratatouille. Anyone can cook, I'm telling you.
Thanks, Jake. You changed my practice. You made me a better person.
Wow, I am so into this love fest. Let's do it again and again. To all of our listeners, a very special Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes. Yeah, I'm waiting, palpitating, with all that meat. And no potatoes.
The Steady is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host today was Rabbi Jessica Minin. Our guest was Jake Cohen. Artwork by Julia Pott. We'll see you next week.
I'm ready with all that meat and no potatoes. I don't think that peas are bad. With me, most anything goes. I look in the pot, I'm fit to fight. 'Cause woman, you know that mess ain't right. All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes. Yes, I'm steaming, I'm really screaming. All that meat and no potatoes.